Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
After its founding by an aristocrat turned spiritualist turned intellectual, Ignatius of Loyola, in 1540, the Society of Jesus, or the Jesuits, established itself as one of the most important of all religious orders. The Jesuits were important in doctrine, politics, missionary work, and famously, education. At times they've been out of favour in the Vatican, but they have produced a pope, Pope Francis, and Marcus Friedrich, professor of early modern history at the University of Hamburg, has written a long, comprehensive, and very readable history of the Jesuits. It was originally published in 2016. It's now out with an English translation. So welcome, Professor.
Welcome, Owen. It's a great pleasure being here.
And I'd just like you to start with telling us a bit about Ignatius of Loyola, who he was, and how it came to be that he got very serious about religion.
Well, Ignatius was, as you just mentioned in your intro, a Spanish nobleman. He lived a very normal life, the life of a normal Spanish nobleman for much of his early career, so to say. He was educated at court. He spent time at various courts of royal and other nobles in northern Spain in the end of the 15th and early 16th century. At these courts, he really imbibed the knightly aristocratic culture of late medieval Europe. He was quick with the sword. He was very concerned about his honor. There was a great dose of machism, we might say today, in his behavior. So there was nothing really unusual about his career for the first almost 30 years of his life. The significant change, or some might even say break, in his biography really came in 1521, when he was severely wounded fighting for the Spanish king against an invading French army. And in that fight, which took place in the northern Spanish city of Pamplona, his leg was seriously injured, which resulted in a week or actually months-long period of suffering. He had to stay in bed for quite extended amounts of time. And during that period, he really changed the course of his life. He claims famously to have had a sort of an illumination, which is, of course, a very traditional trope in Christian literature. And from then on, he refocused his life away from that courtly, noble, knightly culture towards a religious life path, which he then pursued until his death almost 35 years later.
Yeah, and he founded the Jesuits, as I say, in 1540. So when he did that, why did he do it? What was the need for an organization? What was he trying to achieve?
Well, first of all, we should understand that the path between that life-changing, life-altering moment in 1521 and the founding of the Jesuits was a very long one. Ignatius did not have initially in mind very precisely that he wanted to found an order. Actually, quite to the contrary. I think he was first of all trying to find a spiritual path for himself. And over almost 20 years, he reconfigured his own vision of what it meant to be a good Christian, of what it actually was about that his new life should look at. So he experimented a lot in that 2 decades, and only at the very end he ended up founding an order. What he wanted to achieve, there is a famous formula that is common knowledge to all Jesuits and people interested in the Jesuits today. He wanted to help the souls. That's how the Jesuits to this very day define their mission, helping souls. That is what they want. Initially, Ignatius wanted to do that in the Holy Land, and he founded the order, the Jesuits, as we know it, only after some circumstances prevented him and his first bands of friends actually going to the Holy Land. As a plan B, we might say, they had agreed to submit themselves to the Pope, Paul III in that particular case, if they could not go to the Holy Land and actually ask the Pope for a mission of where to go, where best to serve the church in helping the souls, because they assumed that the Pope would have a kind of a global overview over Christianity, so to say, and he should send the Jesuits or the first band of people that were to become the Jesuits to wherever they were most needed. So this is, very briefly put, the story of how the Jesuits were founded.
So when he was trying to help souls, was that the souls of Catholics or the souls of everybody? So it was evangelical as well.
Well, I think it was very quickly expanding beyond anything Ignatius would have had in mind. This very quickly concerned the Catholics, obviously, but then also the non-Catholic Christians, that is the Protestants, but also various groups of Orthodox and Oriental Christians. And very quickly also this concerned the non-Christians. So from very early on, the Jesuits expanded beyond Europe. They went to the Americas, to Asia, and are, of course, as you mentioned already, rightly famous for the work with the newly conquered and newly discovered people around the globe, those people that the Jesuits would have called heathens.
Right. And it seems to me they had money right from the start, because quite quickly they were building buildings, you know, residences, colleges, and becoming quite wealthy.
Well, the Jesuits were indeed and are indeed quite famous for being great fundraisers. So from very early on, as you mentioned, they attracted funding, especially from the wealthy and the rich. They had great networks of patrons. And as we've found out recently, also patronesses, actually the female patrons played a huge role, especially in the early years or decades of the order. So yes, they were very good at fundraising. I suspect this has at least in part to do with Ignatius being a nobleman. So he would have just known from his upbringing and his life at court how to address and how to work with people of high social standing. So yes, they were rich, they attracted a lot of money. But on the other hand, I think we should not overlook that the Jesuits were also almost from the beginning and constantly really facing a lot of situations where they couldn't do what they were called to do because they had not enough money. So the Jesuits turned down a lot of opportunities to found additional colleges, on the one hand because there weren't enough people themselves, so they didn't have the manpower to staff all of them, but then also they turned quite rigidly initiatives down if they thought they were not well funded or not well funded enough.
Right. You say they were short of manpower, but the numbers grew pretty quickly, didn't they? Because it started off in 1540 was it a group of six?
Well, there were 10 at the beginning. And that group of 10 had grown over a long time. So there is a really long history here how Ignatius got to meet this initial band of Jesuits, but that's maybe a different story. And yes, the numbers did grow rapidly. By the end of Ignatius' life, 1556, there are about 1,000 Jesuits. And the real takeoff in manpower occurs towards the end of the 16th century. So yes, this is an amazing story of success if we look at the numbers. And still, the Jesuits often found that they did not have enough manpower to staff and man all the opportunities, all the upcoming things they were asked to do. So in many sources, we actually see the Jesuits deliberating with quite some anguish of what to do, where to go, what they could afford, so to say, to commit themselves to.
And as we run through the early history of the Jesuits, we sort of reach the middle history, I guess, and 1773, when the Jesuits, who had started trying to support the Pope, saying they'd do whatever the Pope wanted, clashed with the Pope, Pope Clement XIV. What happened?
Well, this is a very long story, which I think needs to be broken up into several layers. So I think there is a sort of a long-term history of anti-Jesuit sentiment, which definitely starts in the 16th century, like almost with the beginning and the founding of the Jesuits. There were also voices that were critical of the Jesuits for various reasons. So seen in the long durée, the Jesuits have never been uncontested. Seen in a sort of a mid-range perspective, we may say, maybe, I would argue that the anti-Jesuit sentiment, the criticism of the Jesuits, grew ever stronger after the final decades or so of the 17th century, when some of the cultural preferences that the Jesuits had were becoming out of date, so to say. This long-term anti-Jesuit sentiment really becomes ever more articulated as the 17th century moves on, as new competitors in Catholic culture emerge, most famously the Jansenists in French, who really fought the Jesuits with everything they had. So a newer brand of Catholicism, we may say, became attractive to more and more people. And then there is a short-term history to 1773, which starts somewhere in probably in the second, third of the 18th century, which has a lot to do with political changes, both in Europe and overseas, with changes in state power, with changes in how church-state relations were configured by a new generation of ministers and kings. And I would say, understanding the final demise of the Jesuits in 1773 really has to take into account all of these dimensions, the long-term anti-Jesuit sentiment, which grew during the preceding 100 years or so, and then a series of rather short-term political events in the 1730s, 40s, and 50s.
But when you look at that in the round, would you say that the differences the Jesuits had with other groups and other people were mainly doctrinal, or was it just organizational, personal rivalries, ambition? How would you characterize the differences?
Well, I would say in the end, there were differences or conflicts on pretty much every level that you can imagine. It started with rivalry of older monastic orders, which didn't really understand why a new and highly successful order was needed at all. The anti-Jesuit sentiment very quickly focused on some, we would maybe say, practical issues. So the Jesuits didn't have the regular prayer throughout the day. They didn't wear specifically designed clothes. So they were unusual in many ways, which some of their opponents found highly disturbing. Then there was a political dimension. The Jesuits were accused of being either pro or anti-Spanish, depending on whose side the critics were on. Then there is a doctrinal conflict. The Jesuits held certain positions, or were said to hold certain theological positions, which became increasingly unfashionable. Then there was also a kind of a cultural opposition to the Jesuits. Jesuit pedagogy became increasingly out of tune with early Enlightenment pedagogical ideas. So I would say as we move toward 1773, anti-Jesuit opinion really covers almost every aspect of Jesuit life.
Yeah, lots of issues. But so put it like this, if there was the head of a monastery, a traditional Catholic monastery in, let's say, 1750, and the Jesuits were, you know, knocking on his door, what would he say about the Jesuits, and what would the Jesuits say about him?
Anti-Jesuit sentiment really comes very much into play when we look at printed public discourse and when we come to to political sources. So internal administrative documents, they were very critical of the Jesuits. In practical, everyday terms, I think many Jesuits got quite well along with their rivals or so-called rivals.
No, sure. But they'd say, just to pin this down, a typical traditionalist would say of the Jesuits, I'm worried about you because...
Because you're too lax in moral terms, you allow people to do what they want and then find ways to excuse them. He would also probably say you're too worldly in many ways, focusing on the cultural elite. They would also say, increasingly in the 18th century, you're too backward in your cultural preferences.
See, that's very interesting, because I think today many people have the impression of the Jesuits as very conservative. And yet you're saying, you know, back in, let's say, mid-18th century, people were saying they're too lax. So does that reflect a misunderstanding, a contemporary misunderstanding? How do you see it?
Well, first of all, I would say contemporary Jesuits are very often actually, as I experience it, viewed as being entirely liberal. If you look at the last 3 decades before Pope Francis, for instance, the Jesuits have been often in the line of fire because they were considered to be too left-leaning, too liberal. I mean, they were strongly associated with liberation theology in the Americas, for instance. So I would say the most recent generation or two of the Jesuits is actually considered to be relatively liberal, relatively forward-looking, relatively in tune with contemporary attitudes. I would say the main period in which the Jesuits appeared as, you know, sort of anti-modernist bulwarks of tradition, that really spans sort of much of the Enlightenment era and then the 19th and early 20th century. I think this is the period when the Jesuits were considered to be conservative, backward-looking, anti-modern, really. And I'd say this image isn't quite untrue.
There were phases in the movement's development, basically.
Absolutely. And I would also say, I mean, this is what every historian probably says about his or her topic. It's actually fairly impossible to make valid generalizations about a social body that had up to 30,000 members. So at every time, probably for every Jesuit who confirms the mainstream image, whatever it is, there are many exceptions. Actually, this is really one of the things I wanted to show with my book, and I tried to say so quite explicitly in one of the earliest sections, that it's very difficult, based on contemporary research and the wealth of information that we have now on the Jesuits, that it's actually very different to pin down the Jesuits as being one thing or another exclusively. I would rather highlight the Jesuits are a very colorful, very, very heterogeneous corpus of people who are doing very different things in very different contexts at the very same time. So I think it would be best for all of us to move a little bit away from any attempts of pinning down the Jesuits to being, you know, either conservative or modernist, left-leaning, right-wing. Right-leaning. I think this was an extremely colorful band of people and is to this very day. One of the big goals of my book is trying to overcome, finally, hopefully, some of the traditional stereotypes that are still so popular. I mean, if you type in Jesuit on the internet, you get all kinds of crazy stories and myths about them. And conspiracy theories, which just seem to imagine that a social body of 30,000 people could, you know, just work and function in lockstep, which definitely was never the case.
And one aspect of the Jesuits, which I was unaware of before reading your book, was their involvement with mysticism. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. That is a very interesting and very only recently discovered story, I would say. Traditionally, and for good reasons, people have thought that the Jesuits were very skeptical of mysticism for various reasons, which partly had to do with the Reformation. So mysticism was associated with the Reformation, and the post-Tridentine papacy was generally sort of reluctant to embrace the mystic tradition of Catholicism or Christianity in general. So the Jesuits were often seen as being really critical of mysticism, or certainly not being actively involved in that. And I think this is part of that black legend that still is so popular, you know, seeing the Jesuits as being worldly, matter-of-factly, very well organized. None of these things go well with mysticism, I would say. So recent research has found out that the Jesuits were actually very strongly involved in perpetuating and refashioning that long tradition of mysticism that so strongly shaped Christianity in the late medieval and early modern period. And I think there is much work to be done here, but I think it's now becoming clearer and clearer that the Jesuits really were part of a broader tradition that was quite open to mystical tendencies and incorporated them in very different and interesting ways into their own spiritual framework.
Just to sort of further explain that, could you describe the kind of mystical practice that they might have got involved with?
Well, there were certain forms of, we may say, individual and internal prayers. This was one of the things that was hotly contested towards the end of the 16th century. And initially, some of the Jesuit generals really also cracked down on these form of alternative or supposedly subversive forms of internal prayer, because they thought they were subversive since they didn't involve sort of institutional guidance. I think that was the key thing. But later, as the Baroque period moves on, as we move into the 17th century, I think the Jesuits developed some of the new and long-lasting mystical traditions. For instance, most famously maybe, the devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, which became politically charged in the 19th century as a conservative form of piety. This is a highly mystical form of Christian spirituality, trying to achieve union with the heart of Jesus, which was also depicted in very physical ways. So the Jesuits created a spirituality that was also very much centered on immersing yourself spiritually in the suffering of Christ. These were trends of the 17th and 18th century that the Jesuits really, really wholeheartedly adopted and developed and refined further and promoted very strongly.
And moving away from these religious beliefs and attitudes, is it fair to say the Jesuits tended and have always tended to stay close to power? Is that a feature of the Jesuit movement?
I would answer with a very qualified yes. I think the Jesuits were very much aware from the beginning, and we've talked about that already, that resources are always limited. So the Jesuits were promoting a usage of resources that created the most effect. They assumed that the most effect could be had if you work with the leaders of society, whether they be actually the princes and governments or the cultural and intellectual leaders. So in that sense, I think the Jesuits were interested in working, cooperating with power. They placed much hope in what we would maybe call a trickle-down effect. So, you know, you work with the head of society, and then this will eventually alter the rest of a given society in whatever ways you want. So in that sense, I would say yes. The Jesuits were not keen on getting involved in politics, certainly not the Jesuits as an organization. Individual Jesuits may have been very involved in politics and may have actually, you know, relished being close advisors to kings or princes. But this was not, and I really want to emphasize this was not a general goal of the organization. And these individuals often actually faced harsh criticisms within the Jesuits. Sometimes it was hard to get rid of these powerful and courtly Jesuits because they were just so powerful. So you couldn't really do away with them. But they have not been developed into a general role model of Jesuit behavior. I would strongly emphasize that.
And when you talk about the trickle-down idea, does that explain the Jesuits' emphasis on education? Because, you know, it was a time when this started, it was a time when not many were educated, and they were creating a cadre of people educated in their beliefs.
Yeah, one could call that trickle down, or maybe with a slightly more neutral term here, multiplication effect. So I think they very clearly understood that education was the primary pathway towards what they conceived as re-Christianizing Europe and the world.
Yeah, but the emphasis on education led to another feature of the Jesuits, which people are still aware of today, I think, because, you know, this word Jesuitical sort of means, well, you tell me, but it's very fine reasoning, isn't it? It's the sort of discussion that might happen around the teacher's table at some Jesuit education center.
The way you put it now, Jesuitical sounds like a neutral term. The way I think Jesuitical is at least equally often used is in a highly negative way, sort of almost as an equivalent to lying or hiding intentions or taking refuge to subterfuge or something like that, which isn't absolutely untrue because the Jesuits were often put in social and political context in which they had to find ways to survive political and social pressure. And I think they often walked a fine line between staying true to their Christian and Catholic identity and then also hiding some of the most offensive aspects of their identity. If that is fine reasoning, then it may have grown out of a broader Jesuit academic culture. I think the case people would cite first of all is England in the early modern world. In England, it was legally impossible to survive as a Jesuit. Actually, if you were detected being a Jesuit, you faced the death penalty. So there are scores of Jesuits who actually ended up on the stake in England just for being Jesuits. So
and tell us when that happened.
That was mostly in the 17th century. So there are, I think, about 80 Jesuits or so who actually died in England. We would maybe say as public prisoners, as political prisoners today. And in that context, the Jesuits developed ways of talking about themselves that try to avoid letting people know that they are Jesuits. Is that clear?
Yeah. So they were using their intellectual ability to sort of, maybe slightly disingenuously argue things, and they were under pressure in England at that time because that was the time when basically, the monarchs were trying to Protestantize, if you like, England.
Yeah.
And so, what
yeah.
the Jesuits were seen as the prime example of potentially secret Catholic society. Would that be right?
Yeah, I think that is what comes out of this. That if you put a nasty reading on that Jesuit behavior, you could actually say, well, they are trying to be a fifth column. So this is as I understand it, this is really how that myth of the Jesuits as a fifth column really emerged. That the Jesuits, in some historical circumstances, actually had to hide themselves in their identity, but they weren't keen on doing that. They would actually rather have been allowed to be a Jesuit. And from this, I think the myth of the fifth column, sort of hidden Jesuit, emerges. The wily Jesuit, as the English language has it.
The wily Jesuit. Let's talk about the missionary Jesuit. And perhaps the best illustration of this is China, where there's a lot of controversy about the Jesuits' attitude being quite liberal, if you want to use that word, as you've not encouraged, but they were seen as quite open to Chinese cultural practices in a way that some other Catholics weren't. Can you talk us through that? When did that happen? What went on?
Well, the Jesuits came to China. Well, let me put it the other way around. The Jesuits wanted to come to China almost from the very beginning. So Francis Xavier, the famous first missionary, a close friend of Ignatius, already wanted to enter China in the 1550s, but this didn't happen for various reasons. And de facto, the Jesuits only get into China at the turn of from the 16th to the 17th century. And it takes them a huge effort to establish a very tiny presence in China. I think we need to be realistic here. The Jesuits made only a limited impact on Chinese history in the early modern period. They were, by and large, compared to the huge numbers of people in China, there were only very few converts and only very few of them were culturally or socially really important. The Jesuits got to China, or what success they had in China happened, as you rightly said, through the fact that the Jesuits were very open and very curious about all indigenous cultures, I would say, around the globe. So the Chinese case is no exception here. The Jesuits learned the languages of the places and people they encountered. They also acquainted themselves with Chinese language and Chinese literature. They became producers of Chinese texts themselves. So they started to write and missionize in Chinese. They changed their lifestyle according to local customs. Again, in the case of China, they adopted native dress, native fashion concerning hair and dining and you know, everyday lifestyle. All of this is usually put together or brought together under the label of accommodation. So the Jesuits, as a Catholic order, who were open and willing to accommodate to local culture. There were limits to accommodation, and the limits were there where Jesuits thought that local customs were immoral or offended Christian morals or Christian dogma. Now, wherever this boundary is, of course, is a question of debate and discussion. And this is precisely what happened most famously in China. Other Christians, the Dominicans, for instance, eventually also the papacy, thought that the Jesuits in China endorsed a couple of local practices that they should not have endorsed because these other Christians, the papacy, the Dominicans, considered them to be anti-Christian or to be sinful. One of the most famous examples is the Chinese, so-called Chinese devotion to ancestors, which the Jesuits understood as being only, you know, memorial services, just, you know, a certain ritual at the grave of a forefather that the Chinese conducted in order to, you know, to uphold memory. Whereas other Catholics, eventually also the papacy, thought this were religious rites, Confucian religious rites, and therefore could not be endorsed by Christians. The boundaries of what you could accommodate and what was in accommodatable, so to say, these boundaries were always open for discussion. And sometimes the Jesuits were maybe a little more liberal, yes, than other Catholic actors of the time.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And did that lead to success in terms of their missionary work? Were they good at it?
The balance has to be very different for different regions. I would say there were areas of the world in which Jesuit missionary activities were disastrous failures. Japan being an obvious case. They started off very well in China, but then in the early 17th century, the Jesuits and, in fact, Catholicism was, or Christianity was forbidden in China. There were many people executed for being Christian. So there were huge disasters. Ethiopia also didn't end well for the Jesuits and Roman Christianity. But then there were other areas, Mexico, parts of Southern America, where the Jesuits and other missionary orders that worked alongside with them succeeded in bringing Christianity to those regions in a long-term efficient way.
I see. So you say, yes, I mean, the Jesuits and other Catholic organizations and maybe other Christian organizations were successful in Latin America. But when you look at the Jesuits compared to other Catholic outfits, let's say, Catholic evangelical organizations, how did they compare in that way within the church?
if we compare them to other Catholic actors, I would say the Jesuits were by and large the most prominent, the most, and probably also the most successful propagators of Christianity. If we compare them to non-Catholic missionaries, since you mentioned the evangelicals, I think the question becomes becomes more complex because we're talking about different times. The evangelical Protestant missionary activities only started in the late 18th century at a period when the Catholics and the Jesuits in particular were facing a downward trend. So for much of the 19th century, I would say the evangelicals or the Protestants and the evangelicals were at least as prominent and as successful as the Catholics. And it took the Jesuits in particular quite some time after being reestablished in 1814 to get the missionary work up and running again. I would say the answer has to be different for different periods of Christian missionary history. And in the late 18th and much of the 19th century, I would say evangelical missionary activities were at least as successful and maybe even more successful than their Catholic counterparts.
And just pull this forward to today, if you can, for us. I presume in the course of your research, you visited quite a few Jesuit institutions around the world. Where are they biggest? Where are they most established in the world today?
This is an interesting question because it has to do with Jesuit demographics in maybe the last couple of decades. Obviously, the Jesuit presence in Western Europe and Northern America is dwindling. You know, there are less and less Jesuits. Whereas on the other hand, regions like India, for example, are expanding or at least holding their numbers. So I would say generally there is a shift away from a Europe or North Atlantic focused outlook of the Jesuits towards a more southern outlook, which has been really nicely reflected in the personalities of several of the last Father Generals of the Society of Jesus. With Father Sosa, we have the first sort of true South American non-European Father General in Rome, but several generals before him, while being European by birth and by initial training, have actually moved back to Rome from non-European locations, most famously from Japan. So there has been a de-Europeanization of the Society of Jesus underway for quite a few decades now.
And is the organization still rich?
Yeah, I think it's still, there is still a lot of money. I think with Jesuit and riches, I think we also have to be very careful who we're talking about. The Society of Jesus as a global body hardly has a sort of communal budget. So rich are individual institutions or maybe individual provinces. So if you look at, for instance, individual Jesuit colleges or universities in the United States, they may be said to be rich, but that does not preclude that other Jesuit institutions only down the road are actually very poor. So there is no overall communal budget for all of the Jesuits out of which individual things would be paid. The Jesuit economy really works on a sort of institution by institution and body by body organization.
Right. Okay, that's interesting because one of the tensions, I think, is that, you know, it's a global organization, really, in some ways. And yeah. Yet one of the tensions is that it's, and in that respect, it comes up against nationalist feelings, which are anti-Jesuit, right? Because is it an early example of anti-globalization, that sort of source?
That's very, very interesting question. I don't know if it's anti-globalization, but Jesuit history is deeply connected with the rise of national identities almost from the beginning. So from the beginning, French Jesuits and Spanish Jesuits were fighting against each other about the dominant center of Catholicism, about cultural outlook, so on and so forth. In several moments of Jesuit history, this tension between a global or universal outlook and national priorities really brought the Society of Jesus close to the brink of exploding. Also in the late 20th century, when the Jesuits were in a kind of a mini crisis under Father General Arrupe, there were Jesuits, conservative Jesuits in Spain, who actually proposed that the Spanish branch of the Jesuits should split off the entire Society of Jesus, you know, to be more fully dedicated to the Spanish world. So yes, there is a tension between the global and the national, which is very strong in the Jesuits. I think these days it's also often versus relatively newly Catholicized regions and sort of, you know, traditional heartlands of Christianity. First and third world perspectives are not always easily aligned, even within an order such as the Jesuits, who is so dedicated to, you know, to covering all aspects of Christianity. So yes, there is a lot of tension within the Society of Jesus that at times makes it probably very difficult for them to live up to their universal or global perspective.
Now then, I've read the reviews of your book, which I have to say are, you know, overwhelmingly positive. There are a couple of points in there which I think I should just ask you about. People saying there are omissions or sort of not enough emphasis on. And one is the Jesuits' history with slaveholding. Can you talk us through that?
Well, the facts are the Jesuits owned considerable amounts of slaves themselves well into the 19th century in North America. True is also that the Jesuits had a very sort of lukewarm attitude towards slavery, clearly not opposing it outright. The Jesuits also did a lot of missionary work among enslaved peoples, but that work among slaves never led them to question the institution in any explicit ways. So these are the facts. And I did what I could to address that in my book. This is really one of the interesting things where I found a difference between the European or German reception of the book and the American or US or English reception of the book. Because many people in Germany or in Europe had hardly ever heard and maybe weren't really concerned with that slavery issue. So they found it revealing that somebody could actually write almost 15 pages about that. Whereas some reviewers, as you mentioned, in the United States, for whom issues of slavery are maybe even more part of a daily concern than in Europe, found this not to be enough. So I would say writing the book initially from a German perspective, I did more than what was usual in 2016, but I do appreciate that from societies in which the consequences of slavery are even more prevalent than in Germany, this may have only sparked interest for more.
Right. And what about a second issue, priest abuse, you know, the whole scandals surrounding the Catholic Church of the sexual abuse of children. And yeah, the Jesuits were part of that, right?
Yeah, the Jesuits were part of that. And this is, of course, a very sad story on all fronts. Maybe I should have written more on that, especially as it concerns the most recent developments. This is maybe one of the things I should have focused more about it. Again, on the other side, I would say I actually did wrote a couple of paragraphs about sexuality and child abuse as it relates to the early Jesuit history, so pre-1773. And again, I by the time I was writing that, I considered myself to be pretty innovative of including the topic at all. So I do appreciate the reviewer's wish for more information, and maybe 5 years down the line after first conceiving the book, I would actually give it more attention nowadays. But then on the other side, I think I addressed it in ways that not many people have done it before.
It's quite a long book. How many pages is your book?
I think in the English translation, it runs to slightly more than 800.
Yeah, it's a lot. And I have to say, there's an emphasis on the early history of the church. That's the bulk of your work. But can I just ask you, as we come to a close of this, to look ahead to the future of the Jesuits? Now we've understood their history. How do you see that future? It sounds like you see it mainly in the developing world.
Inevitably, the developing world, if we may use this concept, will play an ever greater role in Christianity at large, so also in the Jesuits. I personally think that the Jesuits may be ahead of the church in general in accepting that and endorsing that. I also think that the Jesuits are facing many of the difficulties that all Christian outfits will face in the coming, I don't know, decades or generations. But I do think that the Jesuits are maybe slightly better equipped to address some of these changes because they are generally more open in engaging with cultural, social shifts and trends, I would say, which maybe brings us back to your opening question about the Jesuit, sort of the basic imperative of the Jesuits. One of the most interesting things of the Society of Jesus, as I see it, is that this fundamental goal of helping the souls does not specify how and in which ways this is to be done, which allows the Jesuits, maybe more than other Catholic bodies, to be ever adjusting, to be open to new trends. You know, if you find a new field in which to help souls, the Jesuits, I think, are fairly easily able to endorse that, which I hope will give them maybe a slightly better chance of weathering future storms than other outfits.
And one final question about what must have been a huge amount of work you put into this. When you were sifting through all those documents over presumably many years, which was the one moment that surprised you most when you went, oh, really? I didn't expect that. What was that moment?
One of the things that really got me looking twice, or maybe actually even thrice, was when I learned that the Jesuits were building fortifications, which is only a small detail now in my book of maybe half a page or so. But that really was the moment, as I look back, that made me realize that there is really no field of early modern and presumably also contemporary culture that was not touched upon by the Jesuits, which then brought me to that overall conclusion that I mentioned earlier already, that the Jesuits are such heterogeneous body that it's really impossible to pin them down to, you know, to any one thing. It's not even possible to say the one thing that the Jesuits didn't do. So this I remember like one of these really moments. They also built forts, and then it you know, this just turned out to be a keystone in my overall puzzle, highlighting that we shouldn't limit the Jesuits to anything.
Professor Friedrich, thanks so much for telling us all about the Jesuits.
Well, thank you, Owen, so much for your interest in my book and my work, and for hosting me here.